from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm David Wright of ABC News, and this is On Point. We're going to be talking this hour about reproductive politics in Ireland. And lest you think, well, that's a bit esoteric, let me reassure you that the abortion debate there involves all of the same issues and arguments that we hear here. And the passions run just as deep. But the Irish are grappling with abortion in a very different way. Abortion is illegal there, always has been. And in 1983, partly in response to the Roe versus Wade decision here, the Irish enshrined in their constitution the principle that a fetus in the womb has equal rights to a mother. They call it the Eighth Amendment. And next week, voters in that historically Catholic country will go to the polls and try and repeal the Eighth. At a time when Ireland's ban on abortion faces what could be its most precarious moment, the laws here in the U.S. that allow abortion face a precarious moment, too. New restrictions and, of course, a changing Supreme Court. This hour, On Point, abortion politics on both sides of the Atlantic. You can join us on air and online. Abortion is a deeply personal political issue, but how and where should we as a society draw the line, and who gets to decide? Join us anytime, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later this hour, former Secretary of State Rex Tillerson and his commencement speech at VMI, including some jabs at President Trump. But first, joining me now from Dublin is Pat Leahy, political editor of the Irish Times. Pat, welcome to On Point.
Hello, David.
Hi there. Abortion has been illegal in Ireland all the way back, but Ireland brought in this Eighth Amendment in 1983, at least partly in response to the Roe versus Wade decision here. Anti-abortion advocates there worried that the same thing could happen in Ireland. What does the Eighth say in a nutshell?
The Eighth Amendment says that the state guarantees the equal right to life of the unborn and the mother, and guarantees, as far as is practicable, to vindicate and defend that right. And what it has done, really, is it has acted, it was introduced, you correctly said in your introduction, partly as a result of the Roe versus Wade decision and fears that the Irish Supreme Court could recognize in the Constitution, in the Irish Constitution, a right to privacy which would extend to a right to abortion. Now, those fears were probably oversold at the time, but how.
There was also the added pressure that Ireland, which had banned contraception, had just allowed contraception in the early 1980s.
Yeah, it had begun to allow contraception in the 1970s, only for married couples in the 1970s, and that right was kind of gradually being extended. I suppose laws in that regard were kind of honored more in the breach than the observance. But certainly those sort of liberalizing legislative and judicial moments that people would be familiar with in the United States through up to Roe versus Wade, they were an element in the Irish public discourse as well, certainly. The liberalization, modernization of Ireland with regard to these sort of social issues probably came later in Ireland than it did in many other similar European countries.
Well, let's get out of the history a little bit and talk about the current moment. How is this campaign playing out? Is it a pitched battle?
Yeah, I mean, it is. It's a very divisive, very intense campaign. I suppose both sides have probably been preparing for this for years. The anti-abortion side, pro-life side, has been anticipating this referendum for several years, and they have prepared and fundraised and that in preparation for that. We've conducted a polling. Is a day from tomorrow. It's on Friday week. We've conducted our final poll of the referendum campaign that we published today, and it shows that when you exclude the undecideds, the yes side, that is the side favouring repeal of the amendment, is in the lead by 58% to 42%. 2%.
Wow.
While that's a substantial lead, it has come down pretty sharply in the last month. By contrast, a poll that we did in late April showed the yes lead at 26%.
So and it's worth mentioning that this landmark referendum comes on the heels of another landmark referendum back in 2015, the constitutional referendum in Ireland to recognize same-sex marriage. This new one proposed by the Taoiseach, who is himself gay. So
that's right.
Ireland's a changing place.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, and you know, by some measures, you know, we are one of the most liberal societies in Europe. But abortion has always been a special case here. I think.
And the Catholic Church still looms large
because of the culture. Yeah, sure. Yeah. I mean, certainly you can't divorce the position of the Catholic Church from abortion law in Ireland. Although that influence and political power and moral authority of the Church has been greatly diminished. Over the last couple of decades, not just by the sort of modernization and urbanization of society that you've seen elsewhere here, but also especially by the child abuse scandals, which have really diminished the voice of the Church in these sort of social and political issues.
Before we let you go, Pat, I wanted to ask you about one more thing, which is the you mentioned fundraising earlier. This has drawn huge interest from anti-abortion groups in this country, so much so that there's been a heated debate in Ireland over ads on Google and Facebook. Tell me about that.
Yeah, this is an interesting aspect of the campaign for everybody, no matter where they are, I think. What we saw in the kind of middle part of the campaign, I mean, we're in its final stages now, but in the middle part of the campaign was a pretty intense effort, mostly on the anti-abortion side, directed through to reach undecided voters or to reach soft yes voters through advertising on the internet, on Facebook, Google, YouTube, and the Google and Facebook became sufficiently alarmed at this that Facebook took the step, which it hasn't taken anywhere else in the world, to block overseas ads or ads sourced or paid for from overseas.
And then Google and YouTube have banned all ads altogether on this issue.
All political ads. They did that the following day, which, and this was just last week, which was a move seen by the anti-abortion side, by the No campaigners, as specifically directed at them. Now, Google and Facebook, not being the most transparent of organizations, have really kind of failed to explain that move or explain what led to it, but it has certainly, I think, disadvantaged the anti-abortion side.
I think they're probably a bit bruised by all the flack that they're taking on this side of the Atlantic over the ads that appeared during the 2016 election. But it'll be interesting to see whether that's a precedent. Pat Leahy, political editor of the Irish Times, thank you so much for joining me.
My pleasure.
All right. We want to turn now to some voices on both sides of this issue. Joining me now from Dublin is Sinead Kennedy. She's co-founder and secretary of the Coalition to Repeal the Eighth Amendment. Sinead, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
Also joining from Dublin is Caroline Simons, legal consultant and spokesperson for the Pro-Life Campaign. Caroline, welcome.
Thank you.
Sinead first, the stories that you hear from women who've had to travel or wanted to travel because they were pregnant and wanted to terminate the pregnancy in Ireland are heartbreaking. And there have also been some huge legal cases in Ireland, as I understand it, that have really touched the entire country. Can you tell us about it?
Yeah, I think that's one of the real kind of marked shifts when you were talking there to Pat about some of the changes that have taken place in Irish society over the last couple of decades. And I think really in the last, particularly in the last kind of 5 years or so, one of the things that I think has characterizes this particular debate at this particular moment around abortion is the stories and voices of women that for the large part in the history of the abortion debate have largely been silent and have largely been absent. And I think that in the last couple of years, very courageous women have come out publicly and told about their stories. And some of them are particularly tragic and heartbreaking. We've heard particularly from women and couples who've been facing into a pregnancy with a fatal fetal anomaly where their baby's going to be born dead. and have had, in these very tragic circumstances, have been refused the medical care here in Ireland and have had to travel abroad. And then we've had one of the characteristics of or one of the effects, I should say, of this Eighth Amendment is that we've had numerous court cases in which with a sort of semi-regularity, another woman is kind of dragged through the legal system.
One of the big ones in recent years, a woman in Galway, an Indian woman who died in an Irish hospital after being refused access to abortion or to be allowed to travel.
Yeah.
Back in the 90s, there was the case they call the X case, a teenager who was raped. Her parents wanted to take her to England for an abortion. They notified the authorities first because they wanted to get the fetus tested for paternity to try to eventually prosecute the rapist. And the attorney general filed for an injunction seeking to prevent her from leaving the country. This tore the country apart, didn't it?
It did, yeah. But it was also, it's more than that. I think it's a bit more than it tore the country apart. I think for the first time, the Ireland's abortion laws had a face. So this comes 9 years after the Eighth Amendment is introduced in 1983. And before that, it had been a very abstract kind of theoretical issue. And then in 1992, I think people were faced with the reality of what the Eighth Amendment meant. And it meant that a 14-year-old rape victim was being had an injunction placed upon her and preventing her from leaving the state in order to access an abortion. And she was brought to the High Court. She lost there, and then she had to appeal it to the Supreme Court. And what was interesting was at this stage, you had demonstrations for the first time really around the issue of abortion, and people, ordinary people coming out saying not just that she should be allowed to travel to Britain, but that she should be allowed to have an abortion here. And that led to another referendum that said, if you are the young girl in the process of this, so traumatized was she became suicidal. And the court ruled that she had a right to an abortion because she was suicidal.
Okay, we need to take a quick break. We're discussing Ireland's referendum to legalize abortion. You can join the conversation. How would you cast your vote on this issue? I'm David Wright, and this is On Point.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for listening to this podcast. If you love to find and hear great new music, but you don't know where to start, let All Songs Considered be your guide. It's NPR's weekly music discussion and discovery podcast with tons of new songs and artists to fall in love with. Hear All Songs Considered in the NPR One app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm David Wright. We're discussing Ireland's abortion referendum and new laws in the U.S. to restrict abortion access. And you can join the conversation. This is an issue that tends to be fought in the extremes. One side shouts murder, the other misogyny. And polls show that most of us live in the gray areas. Where do you come down and why? I'm speaking with Sinead Kennedy, co-founder of the Coalition to Repeal the Eighth Amendment. But let's turn now to Caroline Simons, legal consultant and spokesperson for the Pro-Life Campaign, and hear your thoughts on the discussion so far.
Hello, David.
Hi there.
Hi, how are you? Very nice to be invited on the program, and I'm very happy to let your American listeners know what the campaign is like here in Ireland. The first thing I'd like them to know is that Irish women are not neglected by the health service here. They're very well cared for, and any health complication or threats to the life of a woman in pregnancy are dealt with, and that's reflected in the fact that our maternal mortality rates are so far ahead of yours. I believe in America that for every 100,000 live births, 26.7 women will die. In Ireland, that figure is 6.5. And when it comes to serious threats to health in pregnancy, Ireland also compares favorably with every other jurisdiction in the world. So this is relevant because much of this battle for removing the right to life of the unborn from our constitution is going around the question of whether or not women's health is affected and whether or not women have died because of that provision. And as Pat Leahy has explained, yes, our Constitution does recognize an equal right to life of the mother and the baby, but it undertakes in the Constitution to defend the baby's right to life only as far as is practicable. And so mothers always come first, because if they didn't, then, you know, the baby and the mother would both be lost.
But what about that mother in Galway who died in a hospital bed?
Yes, I'm glad you brought her up. That was Savita Halapanavar. There are a number of cases. There are four, in fact, that the campaigning obstetricians who are looking for repeal, and I do have to say they don't represent most of the obstetricians in the country, and five previous heads of the Institute of Obstetricians for Ireland have come out and said so. And there are four cases that are cited as being evidence for the AIDS having been the cause of death in mothers, and in not single one of them is that true. The case that you have brought up, there were three independent inquiries into the death and the tragic death of Savita Halappanavar. Each one of them, the jury found, in the coroner's court found unanimously that she died by medical misadventure. The HICWA report, which is another independent report here, found 13 cases of missed opportunities to monitor the progress of the infection that eventually overwhelmed and killed her. And the third report, which was carried out by Sir Aral Coomeran, an Englishman leading it for the health service executive here, he found three causes of death and none of them were the Eighth Amendment. He suggested that there might have been a contributing factor of understanding the law, but equally it might have been that she wasn't properly monitored. So there has never been any finding that the AIDS has killed anybody. You also mentioned, or I think Sinead mentioned it, a case where somebody had to go to court. There was a case of Ms. P, a woman who was declared brain dead at 15 weeks, a bit like your case in Texas of Marlene Munoz. And like your case in Texas, she was already dead, and the Eighth Amendment didn't prevent the High Court in Ireland from ordering that the life support be switched off. So, you know, women here in Ireland have access to all the healthcare that they need, no matter what the condition they have in pregnancy. And there's an amount of scaremongering going on. I'm looking at some canvassing material now for the people looking for appeal. They're suggesting that women who are diabetic could go blind in pregnancy if they don't have abortions. You know, this isn't true. Ophthalmic surgeons have come out to say this is absolutely not true. We do terminate pregnancies where it's necessary to save a woman. And that means we deliver babies, and sometimes so early that they're not going to survive. The only thing, David, that the Eighth Amendment prevents doctors in Ireland from doing is deliberately killing babies. And that is in the circumstance where there's not a shred of medical evidence.
And by babies, you mean fetuses still in the womb.
Yeah. That's right. There is no evidence in the international medical literature that killing the fetus in the womb is necessary to address any complication of pregnancy. And we'd recognise that across the world, in England, our nearest neighbour, 97% of abortions are for healthy babies and healthy mothers.
Sinead, your response?
Well, first of all, I mean, I think what the Eighth Amendment says is that a woman has an equal right to life of a fetus, and it sets up a competition between the pregnant woman and the fetus that she's carrying. And the condition here in which doctors can intervene to protect a woman is when her life is at risk. And I think that's a very low bar for women, that simply we can intervene to protect them when their life is at risk. And many, many doctors have come out and have talked about how the Eighth Amendment interferes in providing what they feel is the best and most appropriate clinical treatment for women. So Caroline mentioned the case of Savita Halappanavar, and during the inquest, the consultant who was treating her felt that the Eighth Amendment did affect how she approached the case. Because what happened in that case was because Savita Halappanavar was 16 weeks pregnant, she was miscarrying, and the doctors felt that they could not intervene because of the presence of the fetal heartbeat. So they left her, and that allowed for her to develop sepsis, which was a contributing factor to which she effectively died of sepsis. So the Eighth Amendment has, as many doctors have said, including the master of the National Maternity Hospital, Rona Mahoney, has talked about the chilling effect that the Eighth Amendment has on doctors. Because what it means is that doctors are operating not in a medical context, but in a criminal context, because both a woman and her doctor face criminal penalties of up to 14 years for procuring abortions outside of the very, very rigid circumstances in which it's protected legally. And that also, I mean, one of the reasons why I think we haven't seen more tragic cases is because many of these women choose to travel abroad to Britain where care is provided there for them. So the Eighth Amendment does harm women. It is not some sort of benign statement in the Constitution. It has actually had very demonstrable, caused very demonstrable harms to Irish women, or to women living in Ireland, I should say.
There is so much to discuss here, but I want to bring in some of our callers. The lines are filling up with people eager to contribute a comment or a thought on this. William is calling from Middletown, Connecticut. Hi, William.
Hi, David. I am a second-generation American. All my grandparents were born in Ireland, and of course, this is an issue solely for the Irish people. I came back to the Catholic Church about 15 years ago, and I had to look at this issue personally, because before I was pro-choice, having studied it, I made a decision that personally that fetus is indeed a person, and that I had to, much to the chagrin of my liberal friends, and I'm still liberal in most issues, change my opinion. And I pray, when I heard this show going on, I prayed that the Irish people will maintain the Eighth Amendment as the about the only country in Europe that will have such a law. Thank you.
Thanks very much, William. This debate comes at a time when attitudes toward the church are changing, to say the least. And the church also plays into this debate not just because of the teachings on that life begins at conception, but also it relates to the church abuse scandal, doesn't it? That there were generations of unwed mothers, pregnant mothers, sent to the Magdalene laundries, asylums for fallen women run by Roman Catholic orders that essentially were slave labor, and people were subjected to horrible abuse there. Is that an acceptable alternative? Presumably not, Caroline Simons.
No, absolutely not. And historically, you're absolutely correct. I mean, those were much harder times. Excuse me, those were much harder times. And, you know, the tragedy is that an awful lot of those women were brought to the Magdalene laundries by their parents. There was no other place for them to go to be hidden away at a time when being pregnant outside of marriage was a shameful thing. I mean, what you have said about the Catholic Church and the falling away from church attendance is in general true. It hasn't stopped the Catholic Church or the Presbyterian Church in Ireland from opposing this referendum, and from various Muslim churches coming out against it too. The fact is, those churches and clerics will speak to their own congregations about the moral aspect of this. But generally speaking, the campaign, David, is purely a grassroots, layperson campaign. It's come from the ground up. And basically, you know, we had this legislation back in 2013 that was meant to deal with the case of Savita Halappanavar, that if there was any lack of clarity, it was meant to show that you could terminate pregnancies when it was necessary to save a woman's life. That had been the case since 1983. But it changed practice in one respect, in that for the first time, you were now allowed to do this where the woman threatened suicide, even though all of the psychiatrists came out, every one of them, at the parliamentary hearings and said, this has never been shown to be medically necessary to address suicidality in pregnancy. Abortion is not a medical treatment. And it isn't healthcare. So really, if we were honest, really, we would be debating this on the basis of whether or not people want abortion as a medical service to be made available. It's not healthcare, but it's being argued on the same basis as it was before Roe and Wade in America. And like the case of Roe and Wade, no abortion happened in that case, and no abortion happened in the X case in 1992 either. That young woman was in England with her parents, in fact, when the application for the injunction was made, and she had a miscarriage there. So we're left with a law that is very difficult. There's no evidence of any kind that abortion treats anything in pregnancy. It doesn't treat suicidality. It doesn't treat complications. And abortion in the sense that I mean the direct and intentional killing of the fetus. And that is what the government proposes to legislate for, up to birth in some cases. And if the Eighth Amendment is taken from the Constitution and the people agree to repeal.
Under the Eighth Amendment, when do the rights of the fetus begin? Is it from the moment of conception?
Yeah. At conception. And I must disagree absolutely vehemently and as strongly as I possibly can with the idea that the baby, the fetus, is pitted against its mother.
And what about the idea of rape or incest? In those cases, the fetus has there's no choice but to carry through the pregnancy?
We don't terminate babies in Ireland. That's correct. We don't terminate babies.
Period.
And I know that sounds hard.
Full stop.
And a lot of people would agree with where you seem perhaps to be coming from, David. There are people among the Irish public, and maybe they are sizable. We'll have to wait and see on the 25th. There are people who say, well, look, I think there should be abortion. You should be allowed to terminate the life of the baby in cases of rape, say, or where there's a fatal anomaly. But unfortunately for those people, this proposal, if it goes through, will remove all constitutional protection from all babies in the Constitution. And that means that no matter what protective measures are brought in by just an ordinary Act of Parliament later, they won't be as strong as the really strong constitutionally protected rights that a woman has to autonomy, to bodily integrity, to privacy, to health, etc. So leading academics on both sides of this campaign have said that if the Eighth is removed, we're in a unique constitutional position in Ireland. If the Eighth Amendment is taken away, then unfortunately it will lead to abortion on demand, or in the words of one of the leading legal experts advising the repeal campaign, we might have interim legislation as a stopgap on the way to light touch regulation or almost no regulation at all.
Or they might set regulations that find a middle ground here.
Well,
for you, there is no middle ground, I'm hearing.
No, hold on. if you want to have the hard cases dealt with, then it is within the wit of constitutional lawyers to do that without removing all constitutional protection from all unborn babies. If this happens as is proposed by the government, then we will be like our neighbours, the vast majority, in the case of the UK, as I've said, of abortions, 97%, are done on healthy babies and healthy mothers as a service which is requested by women.
I want to get more phone calls in here. Let's turn to Lisa. She's calling from Baltimore, Maryland.
Hello, David. Thanks for taking my call. Hello, everybody.
An Irish accent there, I hear.
I am actually 17 years living here in Baltimore, but I grew up in Ireland. I remember the referendum in 1983. I was too young then to vote. And then I voted in the 1992 referendum to change travel, to change information, and to enshrine the right. Which was fascinating. And I think I just want to take a step back and maybe just talk about the life of the Constitution. Bunracht na hÉireann, as we call it, is a living document. I think a lot of Americans understand the word Constitution. And living here, and I swore on the Constitution as a citizen. But what I'm fascinated with and very proud of is that our Constitution is a living and breathing document. We go to referendum on it constantly. And I'm very proud of our country that we sit down, that we educate ourselves. And I understand that the debate is very contentious. I realized, like, the other night there in RTE, there was a very contentious live debate. But at the same time, I understand also that it's a conversation among Irish people that people are able to have. They're very informed because our Constitution is such an important document. I'm actually holding it in my hand right now, and it's only €2.54.
It's an interesting point that you make, and it's worth noting that we do not have this process here, at least nationally. There's no initiative process where they can put a referendum on the ballot and have all of us vote on it. Certain states have that. California has it. A few other states do as well. But nationally, constitutional amendments in this country are a good deal more complicated. However, there are changing laws on this, state by state, and also, to some extent, nationally as well, especially in the makeup of the U.S. Supreme Court, which is crucial in protecting this right for American women. Joining me on the phone now from Washington is Christina Catarucci. She's staff writer for Slate. Christina, welcome to On Point. I want to have you bring us up to date on what some of the dynamics are in this country when it comes to this issue.
Hi, David. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us.
Of course. Abortion, as enshrined as a right by the Supreme Court, is legal in the U.S. or must be legal in states up to the point of fetal viability when the fetus can survive outside the womb, which is about 22 to 24 weeks. But recently, states have been getting more aggressive in trying to push that boundary. In March, Mississippi just passed a ban on abortions performed after 15 weeks of pregnancy. Louisiana just passed a similar ban just this week. The governor is expected to sign it. And there are other states like Iowa, which passed a six-week ban on abortion, which, you know, many women don't even find out they're pregnant at 6 weeks of pregnancy. And so these states, you know, the legislators know that the that these are, as Supreme Court precedent stands, unconstitutional, but they're hoping that because Donald Trump is president and Mike Pence is vehemently anti-abortion, that by the time those laws make it up to the Supreme Court, the makeup of the court will be such that they'll reconsider Roe v. Wade and possibly allow states to ban abortion even earlier.
You can hear that music in the background. That means it's time for us to take a quick break. We will be back momentarily with more on this discussion. I'm David Wright. You're listening to On Point.
I'm Ophira Eisenberg. Join me on NPR's Ask Me Another as we challenge contestants and celebrities to nerdy word games, music parodies, and punderful trivia. Find us every week on the NPR One app and wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm David Wright. We're talking reproductive politics in Ireland and here in the U.S. I want to get a final thought from our guests over in Ireland before we turn the focus of the conversation to the debate as it's unfolding here. First, Caroline Symons, you heard there about how the right to access to an abortion here in this country hinges here on the notion of viability, which can be tough to define. But how is it that a collection of cells right after conception could possibly have equal rights to a human being?
Well, you see, we have a different culture here, David. We respect life from its beginning to its end, so we don't have the deliberate termination of the life of fetuses in the womb, and we don't have the deliberate termination of the aged or the infirm or the comatose. We just don't do that medically here. And, you know, we're not talking about pitting one patient against another.
But this is a collection of cells that couldn't possibly survive outside the womb.
Nobody's debating that. But when a doctor sees a pregnant woman in his or her surgery here in Ireland, they regard themselves as morally obliged and duty obliged to look after the two patients who are there in front of them as best they can. And that is what they do. And the whole purpose of this referendum is to change that and to give doctors, in fact, the right to kill rather than to care, and to propose that, you know, a certain segment of humanity, okay, it's very small, it's incipient, it's few cells, but that a certain segment of society doesn't have a right to live. And in most cases, because a woman decides that it doesn't. And I know that might seem so far removed from where you're at now in America since Roe v. Wade in 1973, but that is...
But some would like to take us there, I think.
Some would like to take... Well,
I think some American politicians, some passionate advocates who oppose abortion rights, who mm-hmm. favor the right to life, would like to see that here.
Well, a lot of people would think that, well, I know, but, you know, we're looking at countries, we're told we're not progressive in Ireland, that we need to be more like America, we need to be more like our European neighbours, where, you know, the statistics are absolutely stark. Looking at just the nearest neighbour, we know that in England, for every four babies born, one is aborted. In Denmark and France and in Norway, that's for every three live births, a baby is aborted, and so on. And it's mostly, I think, between one and six, one abortion for every six live births in Germany. These statistics are absolutely stark. In Ireland, for every 20 live births, we have one abortion. And I agree, yes, certainly they occur overseas in England at this point. And even allowing for abortion pills taken in Ireland, and that's a problem, people taking illegal abortion pills everywhere now, as you know, and that would be one in six. So we're looking at the international experience, the fact that across Europe, 30% of pregnancies end in abortion. And we're trying to continue to foster the culture of protecting life. And we are continuing to ask and to push. And I can tell you, no matter what the outcome of the referendum is on the 25th, I and everybody I know in the pro-life movement in Ireland will be demanding from the government not just the voluntary assistance that we all give, but proper supports for women so that they don't have to make the choices which Guttmacher Institute tells us are mostly based on lack of support and lack of financial assistance when people find themselves in unplanned pregnancies. You mentioned
Caroline Symons, we're going to have to leave it there because we've got to save time for the discussion about the debate here in the U.S. Thank you very much for joining us. She's the legal consultant and spokesperson for the pro-life campaign. Sinead Kennedy, some final thoughts?
Yeah, well, I mean, Caroline's right in the sense that the culture here in Ireland is very different to the culture in the United States. In that, in the United States, in, I know not in all states, but in many states, if women need access to abortion care, if their health is at risk, if their life is at risk, or if they do not feel that they can continue on with a pregnancy, they can exercise that the option to make that decision. Here in Ireland, what we say is, well, you can't do that here in Ireland, But because the Constitution says not only there's the Eighth Amendment, it also guarantees that women have a protected right to travel outside the state, which is basically saying, we don't mind if you have an abortion as long as you don't actually have one here in Ireland. So the reality of that is what we're doing is forcing women to travel abroad or forcing women to kind of take illegal abortion pills. And if politicians in the United States think that Ireland is some sort of model, every country, making abortion illegal, and this is the experience right across the world, does not stop women having abortions. It just means that they have them somewhere else or that they have unsafe, unsupported abortions.
I am.
Sinead Kennedy, thank you very much for joining
us.
She's the co-founder and secretary of the Coalition to Repeal the Eighth Amendment in Ireland. Christina Catarucci, where are abortion rights facing the biggest challenge here in this country? Which states?
So Mississippi and Louisiana have most recently passed what would have recently been the most severe abortion restrictions in the U.S., and that's a ban at 15 weeks of pregnancy. Iowa, just in the past month or two, passed a six-week ban, and that is going before a federal court. The Iowa Attorney General has said that he won't defend it, and so he's gotten a pro-life advocacy group to take that case on pro bono. But we're seeing abortion rights attacked in many states.
In Texas, there's been zoning issues that have been brought into play.
And it's funny what Sinead was saying about, women can't access abortion in Ireland, but they're supposed to go elsewhere. That kind of argument, we saw that in Texas, too, when Texas tried to pass laws saying that abortion clinics had to have these exacting building requirements that you would only need in a surgical facility, that they had to get admitting privileges at nearby hospitals. So plenty of abortion clinics closed, and people who defended that law said, well, women could just go outside the state to get an abortion. And so it's that kind of logical inconsistency that pro-choice advocates are pointing to when they say, you're really not trying to protect women's health, which is the other argument that they make, but you're just trying to make it difficult for poor women to get abortion, because wealthy women will always be able to travel outside their state or country to get abortions.
We got a lot of callers on the line. Let's hear from Lucretia calling from Tampa, Florida. Hi, Lucretia.
Hi, David. I'm calling because this issue is really close to my heart. I was at the age of 44. I had a second unplanned but very exciting pregnancy that turned out to be at 21 weeks. We found out the baby was missing one kidney, and the second kidney was in PCDK, which is a genetic condition. It was not functioning, and had a very rapid series of tests and decisions to make, because by 24 weeks, I would not have been able to receive a termination. I wasn't excited about that. I've always supported abortion rights, but I wanted to have that choice. And
right. If
I hadn't been able to do that, I would have had to go to Kansas to get a termination. And I was looking at Kansas. That was the only other state that would do a third trimester abortion, I guess. And, it wasn't an easy decision. And I don't like feeling like I'm a case, as some of your speakers have talked about. I wasn't a case.
You're a person.
I was a
sure.
woman who had a terrible decision to make.
Yeah.
And I did it in love, out of love for my child and myself.
Heartbreaking.
Thank you so much for that story. And this is something when people talk about abortion on demand, abortion up until the last moment of pregnancy, I don't think they realize that, first of all, 91% of abortions, according to the CDC in 2014, were performed in the first trimester. But the abortions that happen much later are usually because of instances like that, really difficult decisions that happen with a fetal abnormality or a life-threatening illness to the mother. And so it's never an easy decision, and it's never because a woman is lazy or waited a long time because she didn't feel like going to the doctor's office.
This is a painful and deeply personal decision, but I guess the in this country, we have the luxury of having it be a decision because of the Roe versus Wade decision. In Ireland, they can't make that decision, right? Or they make it only by traveling outside. Debbie's on the line from Charlotte, North Carolina. Debbie?
Hi, David. I'm calling. I, too, had a termination, and my heart breaks for your previous caller. However, over time, I've come to the conclusion that it wasn't right. I understand now that every human has a right, and the legal system identifies people by their DNA. And every child in the womb has their own DNA. And that magic question of when did you become you and when did I become me, I think that's been solved. And just because it was legal didn't mean it was okay. And it was a fear-based decision. And I'm now on the other side saying we should just be giving support to pregnant women and not forcing them to choose. They shouldn't have to choose. We shouldn't have to feel that pressure of, okay, does this child deserve to live? And as a mother now, I look back and I think, oh my goodness, the only difference between my living children now and the child I aborted in college was time. And I would certainly...
But time is a valid thing, isn't it? I mean...
When do you suddenly say that someone's life is worth living or not? You know, when someone becomes a quadriplegic and can't support themselves and they need someone to feed them, they still have a valid intrinsic worth as a human. So the moment that we start using euphemisms and calling humans fetuses and things like that, then we are...
For you, it's a baby, even if it's just a collection of cells right after conception?
It's not just a collection of cells. There's a unique DNA. And
a zygote?
Did you become you?
I don't know. I think that's the crucial question, and that's why this is a question that the church takes such an intense interest in, because that is an existential question at the heart of a political debate, at the heart of the personal lives of people. And I think it's especially thorny. This is a tricky issue the world over. Christina Catarucci, is there any guess at this point, if the Supreme Court were faced with a challenge today, would Roe versus Wade stay intact?
My guess, I don't want to jinx anything, but my guess would be that the Supreme Court today would uphold Roe versus Wade. In 2016, the court, which, you know, was no more conservative necessarily than it is now, decided not to take on a few challenges to Roe versus Wade. I think they were 12-week abortion bans. So I don't think that the current court is willing to reconsider that precedent. But you really never know. I mean, Neil Gorsuch is on the court now. He wasn't back then. There's a couple. The Eighth Circuit, for instance, is a court in the U.S., a federal circuit court that's encouraged the Supreme Court to reconsider. So once the cases get up there, it's really anyone's guess.
Christina Catarucci, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. She is staff writer for Slate. Thank you very much. We're going to switch gears in just a moment, but you're listening to On Point. Switching gears just a bit now, it is commencement season, and congrats to all the graduates out there. Yesterday, the graduating class at the Virginia Military Institute got an earful from former Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, a rare appearance. He's kept a pretty low profile since the president fired him in a tweet 2 months ago. Tillerson told graduates to uphold the nation's democracy and to guard its integrity. Let's give a listen.
As I reflect upon the state of our American democracy, I observe a growing crisis in ethics and integrity. Above the entrance to the main building on the campus of my alma mater in Austin, Texas, are inscribed the words, "Ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." It comes from the book of John, chapter 8, verse 32. "You shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." The founders of our American democracy were, I believe many agree, were crafting the structure and foundational documents guided by divine inspiration, if not divine intervention. An essential tenet of a free society, a free people, is access to the truth. a government structure, and a societal understanding that freedom to seek the truth is the very essence of freedom itself. You shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. It is only by a fierce defense of the truth and a common set of facts that we create the conditions for a democratic, free society comprised of richly diverse peoples, that those free people can explore and find solutions to the very challenges confronting a complex society of free people. If our leaders seek to conceal the truth, or we as people become accepting of alternative realities that are no longer grounded in facts, then we as American citizens are on a pathway to relinquishing our freedom. This is the life of non-democratic societies, comprised of people who are not free to seek the truth. We know them well. Societies in Russia, China, Iran, North Korea. You can complete the list. A responsibility of every American citizen to each other is to preserve and protect our freedom by recognizing what truth is and is not, what a fact is and is not, and begin by holding ourselves accountable to truthfulness and demand our pursuit of America's future be fact-based, not based on wishful thinking, not hoped-for outcomes made in shallow promises, but with a clear-eyed view of the facts as they are and guided by the truth that will set us free to seek solutions to our most daunting challenges. It is also that foundational commitment to truth and facts that binds us to other like-minded democratic nations, that we Americans will always deal with them from the same set of truths and facts. And it is truth that says to our adversaries, we say what we mean, and we mean what we say. When we as people, a free people, go wobbly on the truth, even on what may seem the most trivial of matters, we go wobbly on America. If we do not, as Americans, confront the crisis of ethics and integrity in our society and among our leaders in both public and private sector, and regrettably at times even the nonprofit sector, then American democracy as we know it is entering its twilight years.
The thoughts of former Secretary of State Rex Tillerson addressing the class of 2018 at the Virginia Military Institute. You can watch his whole speech at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm David Wright, and this is On Point.